Specialist on Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
And welcome to the Daily Traditionalist. Today's date is the 29th of May 2017. Happy Memorial Day to our listeners in America. It's also St. Maximus of Trier's Day today, and it's a bank holiday in Britain. I'm not sure why we have a bank holiday today. I'm sure it probably has some origin in a holy holiday. I don't like the idea that the banks are giving us these holidays. At least there's a reason for having a holiday over there in America today. And I'm pleased to welcome one of our American friends to join us today. We have the second in command from Florian Geyer's mysterious fascies team, Doc Savage. Doc, how are you doing today?
Hi, how you guys doing? I'm doing very well, and it's a great day here. Very beautiful weather. And Memorial Day is our particular day here, stateside, to remember those who have fallen in defense of our republic. And while we're not huge fans of republics in principle, it is difficult to separate the people for whom they were fighting from the government they were fighting. And so it is auspicious, I believe, for us to remember our fallen, because ultimately they were, regardless of what they were used for, they believed they were fighting for us. And we should remember that.
Well, yeah, they're patriots fighting for their country, fighting for their people, whether the people that were actually directing them were right or not, the people that actually gave their lives up for their nation. No greater love does a man have than to lay down his life for his friends, and no greater love does a man have for his nation than to lay down his life for his country. So it's good that we remember them. We remember them here in November in Britain, and the National Front always have a march to remember the fallen. It's an important day. And you always get the leftists complaining about it and trying to say, oh, we should get rid of war, all the pacifists saying we should have no borders. But of course, if you get rid of all your weapons, it doesn't mean you get rid of war. It just means that you've just left your country wide open to be invaded by somebody who does have weapons. And usually it's somebody who isn't going to be so civilized as we are. As white people, you wouldn't want to be invaded by the Chinese. You wouldn't want to be invaded by Negroes. If you're going to have to be ruled by somebody, then you want to be ruled by the white race. Look at all the wonderful things that we did for these countries like India and Africa. I know they complain about British Empire not treating them very well in some instances, but at least they learn how to read and write. At least they've got telecommunications, they've got hospitals, they know about science, they can add up, they know how to extract the mineral wealth that their countries had. I think overall, if you were to go to those people today and say, who would you like to have running your country, your corrupt leaders or the white men that were running it before, I think a lot of them would say they would rather have white people running it. And of course, this is because we have this long history of civilization and building civilizations and building up countries and building up nations and working together. And it works okay when it's just white people. When you try to bring in these other races, that's when we get these problems. And I think what we're going to talk about a little bit more today is this civilization building aspect of the white race that I guess was best exemplified by the First Reich, the Holy Roman Empire, 1,000 years, I believe, that lasted for. I mean, that's quite something, a 1,000-year Reich. And the European Union today is falling apart at the seams because it isn't following these same ideas that first came to fruition in this First Reich. Doc, I'll pass it over to you to talk some more about the Holy Roman Reich.
Yeah, well, so the first thing to understand about the First Reich, about the Holy Roman Empire, is that it is founded in martial virtue, right? The deeds that led to the first emperor being crowned, Charles the Great, Charlemagne, were fundamentally military in nature. And what we're talking about specifically is defending Europe against Muslim invasion. So right off the bat, we have the defense of white, of Aryan Christendom against the brown hordes of Islam, against the orcs, really. And that theme stays true right the way through all of the imperial history that would follow. But that we have to understand that this martial virtue is sacralized. That's why it's a Holy Roman Empire. That's why Charlemagne is crowned by the Pope on Christmas Day, right? So in the person of the emperor, we have a unification of a sacred authority and a temporal martial authority in one person.
So you have the strength, you have the power there, you have the might is right, and the might truly is right because it's the might of God. And he's trying to bring about God's law and keep God's law among the people that he is ruling, as it were, the empire. That was the one law, the common law that they all had was the common law of Christendom, the common law of the Bible. And he was the focal point of that. So he had to set a good example to the people because that was who everyone would be looking up to. And I believe another good part about this was that there wasn't really so much room for corruption because it wasn't hereditary. The emperor was chosen from among these princes. The princes would vote for who they wanted to be the emperor. And who is the best person to choose who is going to rule the people, but the rulers of the people rather than the mob. You want people that know what they are talking about, and you want the best person out of the royal family to be chosen to be that emperor. So you had an empire of different nations, and they would choose the very best person who would then be crowned as the emperor, as well as the, I believe he was king of Rome first, or king of the Romans, he would get crowned first, and then he would be emperor. So you had the, as you say, the secular, which was the king of Rome, and then the religious, which was the emperor side of it, all in one man. So it wasn't out of balance like we have now, where we just have politics and materialism, and the politicians do all they can to keep religion away from state. You had religion and you had politics together in one man, but both evenly balanced, I guess, is what they were hoping to achieve.
Well, I just wanted to back up a moment. I'm really glad you brought up the elective nature of the crown. One of the criticisms that you often find of monarchical thinking in the modern day is, well, how do you get a king? Right? It's all very well and good to say, you know, we should have a king, but how do you find one? And it's important to understand that all monarchies, all kingships, all thrones, all crowns started off as elective, right? Now, this is not an election as we understand it today. We're not talking about someone running for king, right? There's no campaign. There's no commercials, right? Usually this election is literally on the battlefield, right? The men who were instrumental in achieving this victory would recognize the leadership that won the day, and they would hail someone as king. And this goes back to the Roman Empire, where emperors would be chosen by the army, literally. And the title imperator, which we now know as emperor, originally means basically conqueror, right? So the acclamation starts on the battlefield. And so when we talk about these dukes these great princes acclaiming an emperor, we have to understand that as these are the leaders of the army, right? These are the men who will be the primary vassals, which is both a political office and a military office at the same time, choosing who will be essentially their commander in chief. Now, as to the political and the spiritual, that's not to say that the church is identical with the state, but it is inseparable and they are intermingled, and that the emperorship and kingship in general has a sacral role, a ritual role. And this goes way back. One of the common sayings of medieval Europe is that the hands of the king are the hands of a healer. And all of the great crowns of Christendom had a specific ailment that they were, that they had the reputation of being particularly strong against.
So they could heal people. The kings could heal people.
Exactly. Wow.
I wasn't aware of that.
And this was just taken as granted. This is the world our ancestors lived in, and I have no reason to doubt my ancestors. Kingship is fundamentally a spiritual thing. He's not just the best of us in a material or physical sense, or even an educated sense, but in a spiritual sense. And he is the link between the divine hierarchy and the worldly hierarchy. He's literally an icon, an image of Christ the King for us today. And that's one of the reasons why the Western liturgy, was fundamentally, formed by, the courtly ritual of the Carolingian kings, of the line of kings that descend from Charles the Great. Kneeling to the king, or our own lord, you know, typically we're not directly under the king, but kneeling to the one who is above us is practice for kneeling to the one who is above everyone. And it's interesting to note that medieval depictions of devils very, very often show them as not as having legs that don't have knees, no joints in their legs. And to signifying that demons not only refuse to kneel, but can no longer kneel. And that's why they're demons.
Like the stiff-necked ones. It talks about in the
exactly.
Bible, the stiff-necked.
Yeah.
You can't bow the neck. I've just... thinking about this healing, I've been reading Bee's Ecclesiastical History of Britain, and right the way through it, he's talking about getting splinters from coffins or bits of earth where saints have died, and using this as medicine. And it obviously worked, and he talks about this actually working, and the people must have believed in this. And that was pretty much their science of the day, was this belief in saints and belief in kings, and it worked. I mean, we have our science today, and we all believe in it. Most of us couldn't actually tell you the mechanics behind it, but the church could tell you the mechanics behind all of this, behind all of this earth from where people had died and these relics that would heal people, and they would actually heal people. So I have no problem with believing that the kings could do that. And as you say, our ancestors said this as well. I mean, they wrote this. They said this is what happens. So you have no reason to doubt them, other than 21st century cynicism through brainwashing at school and otherwise. And just to take it back to these people, that these dukes and these princes. So they were on the battlefield, and they would say, "Hail the king!" And it would be the best fighter, the one who had really proved his mettle on the battlefield. But surely they were from these royal families in the first place, because the royal families go way back, don't they?
Oh yes, yes. It's not to say that this is somehow democratic, that anyone could, you know, be just some guy, some peasant, honestly, could become king. Not generally, no. I mean, I'm not saying it never happened, but breeding was important. And important for many reasons, right? Because it takes quite a lot of leisure time to create this shining individual, right? I mean, that's why the Spartans needed the Helots, because it takes directed labor to produce a class with enough free time and calories to train to create a professional soldier, right? And so, yeah, breeding was always very important. And, you know, just to be considered, you know, kingable or just to be considered a contender to be elected as emperor, you had to have the breeding, you know, or else no one would consider you. And people who didn't have, who couldn't show their ancestry back generations, they were seen as upstarts. And they had to work twice as hard to prove themselves.
They weren't free men, were they? We had back in Britain, we had the Druids. They had to show that they were free men for 10 generations back before they could even study. And you had to have a defensive force, a really good, strong defensive force that could defend the country from invasion before you could have all these civilizational arts, as you were saying, with the leisure time there. And when we get to the time of King Alfred the Great, he managed to repel all the Vikings from the island, all the invaders. He made the island safe. Once he'd made the island safe, he was able to set up schools to educate the people. He built all these boroughs, these burhs, these defended areas. He hanged loads of corrupt judges, set up a new court system, translated the Bible into English. All these literary and scientific pursuits they were able to do. But it was only once they had set up this strong defensive force in the first place. And once they had set up this strong defensive force in the first place that was obviously used to killing people and fighting, these people were then able to raise their spirits, as it were. They were able to study the Bible, study morality, study philosophy, all these other pursuits. So it wasn't just the strong man rules. It was the strong in body and strong in mind and strong in soul. All of these things were exemplified, and the king should exemplify all of that. You know, and I believe going way back, it was the priests that would anoint the king with oil. God would show the priests who the royal line was supposed to be. They would be anointed with oil. And then from that time on, we then get these kings, and the Romans actually killed their king. So they didn't actually have a king, which is why they would intermarry with the British kings when they were ruling in Britain, or when they had a treaty with the British people and they were occupying areas in Britain, they would marry into the British royal family so that they would then have a claim on the Senate, so that they could then say, our children have royal blood, we have this noble blood, and then they would be in a position to get put into the higher classes of the Romans. So I think that's where this idea of kingship goes back to. And by the time we get to the time of the Holy Roman Empire, you've got lots of these families, and not just from Rome and from Britain, but all over the place that could trace their lineage back, most of the time going all the way back to Troy. And the peasants, they were just as important. I mean, the peasant class was needed for the farming. And once you've got a settled area, you need all these roads to be built, and you need these farms on the outside so that they can bring the food in from the farms to the intellectual class that are in the cities. So you have a whole system that's functioning, but it all starts with setting up borders and defending those borders. And the Holy Roman Empire started off with setting up borders, defending the borders from the Muslims. And we've got this same situation today. We've got our borders are down. The Muslims are pouring in. With the way that you're explaining this, Doc, it does actually give me hope that we might have a Fourth Reich, and it may be this Muslim invasion that precipitates it, because it is eventually going to come down to war on the streets. It's going to come down to blood on the streets, and we will have to repel the invaders, just the same as Charles the Great did, just the same as Charles the Hammer Martel.
Absolutely. And it will be in this cauldron, this fire that will either make or break us. You know, we'll either be tempered into a harder, stronger, finer steel, or we will not survive. We will be, you know, we have to have faith that, that we're going to make it, because, you know, the alternative is literally unthinkable. But within this fire, this forge of history, this struggle, the best of us will rise up, and the, you know, a new leadership will emerge, and there will be a new hierarchy. And it's important to note that what this system was entirely based upon personal responsibility. People had to be personally responsible for their actions, the outcomes of their actions, and they had to be responsible to their subordinates and to their overlords, right? This entire system that we call feudalism today was entirely based upon personal relationships. Right? This has nothing to do with some sort of Enlightenment theory of social contract and authority arising out of the consent of the governed this abstract system of nonsense. This is, I am the strongest. I am your overlord. I provide you good lordship. I create the bounds of your world that allow you to be prosperous. And in return, you provide me with good service, right? And so, a tenth of the fruit of your labor, you know, is mine, because I'm the one who's making your labor possible. And then, and also, I'm also responsible for providing you with justice. If someone is doing you ill, it is my duty, it is my responsibility to correct it. And to mediate between disputes. If the miller is ripping you off, then I have to go have a talk with the miller. You know, if someone is selling corrupted coinage, then I have to deal with that. speaking of Alfred the Great, there was a great incident where there were fraudsters who were making debased coins, and he dealt with it quite harshly, made them eat the liquid gold that they had stolen.
Serves them right. Yeah, just to take it back there, what you were saying about the struggle and being forged in the fire. I mean, this just goes to show, I mean, Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf, he wasn't talking about something new. He was continuing this idea that's always been there. That's why he was talking about the Third Reich and referring to the First Reich and the Holy Roman Empire, and the title of the book, Struggle, Mein Kampf, because it is only through the struggle that we improve ourselves. This idea, this way that we used to live, that was the way that we had always lived. And this is the way that we should be living now. We shouldn't be living under this false democracy, this idea that we can be ruled by the masses, and that the masses are the ones best qualified to have a say in who should be ruling us. It should be rule by merit. It should be people with the most merit. And unfortunately, we've killed off our kings. The French killed off their king. We killed off our king in Britain. The Bolsheviks killed off the Russian king. And it was only the king that really had our best interests at heart. I mean, what is a king if he doesn't have his people? He's absolutely nothing. And it was the king that the poor people used to look to solve their problems against the rich. And now it's the rich that are running everything. The prime minister, the president, the government is all run by these banks. Whereas our leader used to be the one that stood between us and the banks. And now the banks have taken over that role, and through their love of money, I guess, and their hatred of white people, that's why Europe is being flooded by this cheap labor and these Muslims. It does seem like history goes around in cycles, doesn't it? And it's the same threat that we're facing again today. And we've all been lied to and told that this threat never existed in the past, when it clearly did. I forget how many times the Ottomans tried to take the Holy Roman Empire. I was looking into it today. I think it was 8 times or something they tried to get into Vienna or repelled, something like that.
Oh, I mean, it was constant back and forth. I mean, yeah, there were multiple sieges of Vienna. Of course, the greatest attack was in 1630-something, I want to say. The day the siege was broken, it was, ironically enough, September the 11th, when the Poles charged to the rescue and broke the Turkish lines, the Ottoman lines outside of Vienna. And it should be noted, I mean, this is the nick of time. I mean, they had succeeded in breaching the walls and were in the middle of assaulting the breach, trying to make entrance to this. I mean, this is a great epic stuff. I mean, this is forget about Battle of Helm's Deep or anything like that. I mean, just look at the siege of Vienna. Amazing. And, you know, the winged lancers, with their great rattling, wings. Charging the lines, completely outnumbered, not caring, not giving a darn. Just amazing, heroic, miraculous stuff.
Yeah, it's inspirational. It was a faith that they had that gave them that strength to do that. This is why we have such a problem today. Look at the Muslims. It's their faith that they're going to get these virgins when they blow themselves up in the afterlife. They don't care that they're going to die. This is why we have such a problem with curtailing Islamic terrorism, is because they have a faith in the afterlife. And we seem to not place such little value on that nowadays.
Well, I mean, we have nothing to live for, let alone nothing to die for. I mean, we have so much ennui and alienation from our society and from our bloodline, from our race, that we're committing suicide, either like literally committing suicide or slowly just poisoning ourselves with alcohol and drugs and pornography and all, and just spiritual and bodily poisons, just completely unchecked throughout our society. We're completely in crisis because we have nothing to live for, let alone die for. And, the state of affairs cannot stay true. Now, how long it will take us to wake up, I don't know. But, nothing focuses the mind like the prospect of death. So, bring on the struggle.
Well, I think it helps to be learning stuff like this, especially about our history and about the battles that we fought and who these battles were against. So they weren't against a faceless enemy. It was against Islam. They may have been called the Ottomans, the Ottoman Turks, but it was still Islam. Before that, it was Islam that Charles the Hammer fought against, Charles Martel. It's the same alien ideology that was held by non-whites trying to break into Europe that we were fighting against. In this history of these brave people, I mean, these battles that you were talking about there, Doc, I know very little about them. I've seen the artwork, the paintings depicting some of them, but there must be records of them and records of what happened in them, the same as we have records of what happened in battles today. And I would suggest it would be very inspirational to learn more about them, learn what our ancestors were like. The age of chivalry fascinates me. Just instead of having this guilt that we are taught to feel about the British Empire and slavery and all that nonsense, what we really should be studying is the great things that we achieved in the past, like the Holy Roman Empire. I mean, that is an incredible achievement. And I'd never really looked into this until you said it would be a good subject to discuss, Doc. But it really is fascinating.
Yeah, well, I mean, and again, just to go back to the origin of our conversation, you know, this First Reich is why you know, this is why the Führer was struggling. His struggle was to found a Third Reich, specifically because that he knew, he was convinced that that's what was needed. That was the only thing that could save our race from two threats: internal degeneration, which was already at that time quite advanced. I mean, just look at the Weimar Republic, and also the alien hordes. You know, it was remarkably foresighted of him to realize that if our strength failed us, that the brown hordes would be back at Europe's gates. Because at the time, it seemed like Europe must have been astride the world. You know, everyone was under European rulership. But if our strength fails us, that situation could be reversed so quickly. And it has. And it's interesting to note that the first time that the empire gained the title Sacrum, Imperium Romanum Sacrum, was under Frederick Barbarossa, Frederick the First. And that is the name of the name chosen as the code name for the crusade against Bolshevism. He knew exactly what he was doing. He knew exactly the imagery, the mythos that he was evoking and trying to instantiate in these latter days. And, you know, like we say here in the South, if at first you don't succeed, try again.
Well, yeah, and this is what we've got to institute. We've got to institute the Fourth Reich, and we have the perfect conditions for it. It's obviously not exclusively German. The Holy Roman Empire wasn't exclusively German. This is another point we need to get across to people when we talk about National Socialism, the Third Reich, the Fourth Reich. It's not exclusively German, but it is exclusively Aryan. Doc Savage, thank you very much for coming on today. Hopefully we'll have you back again next week. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with Florian Geyer. So until then, hail victory.
You've been listening to The Daily Traditionalist on Radio Aryan at Radio Aryan.